Anne stared at Dr. Francis as if unable to comprehend his words. The doctor walked them to the hospital's front door. People were entering and leaving the hospital. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. Anne was aware of how slowly, almost reluctantly, she moved her feet. It seemed to her that Dr. Francis was making them leave when she felt they should stay, when it would be more the right thing to do to stay. She gazed out into the parking lot and then turned around and looked back at the front of the hospital. She began shaking her head.
"No, no," she said. "I can't leave him here, no."
She heard herself say that and thought how unfair it was that the only words that came out were the sort of words used on TV shows, where people were stunned by violent or sudden deaths. She wanted her words to be her own.
"No,"
she said, and for some reason the memory of the Negro woman's head lolling on the woman's shoulder came to her.
"No,"
she said again.
"I'll be talking to you later in the day," the doctor was saying to Howard. "There are still some things that have to be done, things that have to be cleared up to our satisfaction, some things that need explaining." "An autopsy," Howard said.
Dr. Francis nodded.
"I understand," Howard said. Then he said, "Oh, Jesus. No, I don't understand, doctor. I can't. I just can't."
Dr. Francis put his arm around Howard's shoulders.
"I'm sorry. God, how I'm sorry."
He let go of Howard's shoulders and held out his hand. Howard looked at the hand, and then he took it. Dr. Francis put his arms around Anne once more. He seemed full of some goodness she didn't understand. She let her head rest on his shoulder, but her eyes stayed open. She kept looking at the hospital. As they drove out of the parking lot, she looked back at the hospital. At home, she sat on the sofa with her hands in her coat pockets. Howard closed the door to the child's room. He got the coffee maker going, and then he found an empty box. He had thought to pick up some of the child's things that were scattered around the living room. But instead, he sat down beside her on the sofa, pushed the box to one side, and leaned forward, arms between his knees. He began to weep. She pulled his head over into her lap and patted his shoulder.
"He's gone," she said.
She kept patting his shoulder. Over his sobs, she could hear the coffee maker hissing in the kitchen.
"There, there," she said tenderly. "Howard, he's gone. He's gone, and now we'll have to get used to that, to being alone."
In a little while, Howard got up and began moving aimlessly around the room with the box, not putting anything into it, but collecting some things together on the floor at one end of the sofa. She continued to sit with her hands in her coat pockets. Howard put the box down and brought coffee into the living room. Later, Anne made calls to relatives. After each call had been placed and the party had answered, Anne would blurt out a few words and cry for a minute. Then she would quietly explain in a measured voice what had happened and tell them about arrangements. Howard took the box out to the garage where he saw the child's bicycle. He dropped the box and sat down on the pavement beside the bicycle. He took hold of the bicycle awkwardly so that it leaned against his chest. He held it, the rubber pedals sticking into his chest. He gave the wheel a turn. Anne hung up the telephone after talking to her sister. She was looking up another number when the telephone rang. She picked it up on the first ring. "Hello," she said, and she heard something in the background, a humming noise. "Hello," she said. "For God's sake," she said. "Who is this? What do you want?"
"You're Scotty. I got him ready for you," the man's voice said. "Did you forget him?"
"You evil bastard," she shouted into the receiver. "How can you do this, you evil son of a bitch?"
"Scotty," the man said. "Have you forgotten about Scotty?"
Then the man hung up on her. Howard heard the shouting and came in to find her with her head on her arms over the table, weeping. He picked up the receiver and listened to the dial tone. Much later, just before midnight,
After they had dealt with many things, the telephone rang again.
You answer it, she said. Howard, it's him, I know.
They were sitting at the kitchen table with coffee in front of them. Howard had a small glass of whiskey beside his cup. He answered on the third ring.
Hello, he said. Who is this? Hello? Hello?
The line went dead.
We hung up, Howard said. Whoever it was.
It was him, she said. That bastard. I'd like to kill him, she said. I'd like to shoot him and watch him kick, she said.
Ian, my God, he said.
Could you hear anything, she said. In the background? A noise, machinery, something humming?
Not really, nothing like that, he said. There wasn't much time. I think there was some radio music. Yes, there was a radio going, that's all I could tell. I don't know what in God's name is going on, he said.
She shook her head. If I could get my hands on him. It came to her then. She knew who it was. Scotty, the cake, the telephone number. She pushed the chair away from the table and got up. Drive me down to the shopping center, she said. Howard.
What are you saying?
The shopping center. I know who it is who's calling. I know who it is. It's the baker, the son of a bitching baker, Howard. I had him bake a cake for Scotty's birthday. That's who's calling. That's who has the number and keeps calling us. To harass us about that cake. The baker, that bastard.
They drove down to the shopping center. The sky was clear and stars were out. It was cold, and they ran the heater in the car. They parked in front of the bakery. All of the shops and stores were closed, but there were cars at the far end of the lot in front of the movie theater. The bakery windows were dark, but when they looked through the glass, they could see a light in the back room and now and then a big man in an apron moving in and out of the white, even light. Through the glass, she could see the display cases and some little tables with chairs. She tried the door. She rapped on the glass. But if the baker heard them, he gave no sign. He didn't look in their direction. They drove around behind the bakery and parked. They got out of the car. There was a lighted window too high up for them to see inside. A sign near the back door said, "The Pantry Bakery, Special Orders." She could hear faintly a radio playing inside, and something creak, an oven door as it was pulled down. She knocked on the door and waited. Then she knocked again, louder. The radio was turned down, and there was a scraping sound now, the distinct sound of something, a drawer, being pulled open and then closed. Someone unlocked the door and opened it. The baker stood in the light and peered out at them.
"I'm closed for business," he said. "What do you want at this hour? It's midnight. Are you drunk or something?"
She stepped into the light that fell through the open door. He blinked his heavy lids as he recognized her.
"It's you," he said.
"It's me," she said. "Scotty's mother. This is Scotty's father. We'd like to come in."
The baker said,
"I'm busy now. I have work to do."
She had stepped inside the doorway anyway. Howard came in behind her. The baker moved back.
"It smells like a bakery in here. Doesn't it smell like a bakery in here, Howard?"
"What do you want?"
the baker said.
"Maybe you want your cake?" "That's it. You decided you want your cake. You ordered a cake, didn't you?"
"You're pretty smart for a baker," she said. "Howard, this is the man who's been calling us."
She clenched her fists. She stared at him fiercely. There was a deep burning inside her, an anger that made her feel larger than herself, larger than either of these men.
"Just a minute here," the baker said. "You want to pick up your 3-day-old cake? That it? I don't want to argue with you, lady. There it sits over there, getting stale. I'll give it to you for half of what I quoted you. No, you want it? You can have it. It's no good to me, no good to anyone now. It cost me time and money to make that cake. If you want it, okay. If you don't, that's okay, too. I have to get back to work."
He looked at them and rolled his tongue behind his teeth.
"More cakes," she said.
She knew she was in control of it, of what was increasing in her.
She was calm.
Lady, I work 16 hours a day in this place to earn a living, the baker said. He wiped his hands on his apron. I work night and day in here trying to make ends meet.
A look crossed Anne's face that made the baker move back and say,
No trouble now.
He reached to the counter and picked up a rolling pin with his right hand and began to tap it against the palm of his other hand.
You want the cake or not? I have to get back to work. Baker's work at night, he said again.
His eyes were small, mean-looking, she thought, nearly lost in the bristly flesh around his cheeks. His neck was thick with fat.
I know bakers work at night, Anne said. They make phone calls at night, too,
you bastard, she said. The baker continued to tap the rolling pin against his hand. He glanced at Howard.
Careful, careful, he said to Howard.
My son's dead, she said with a cold, even finality. He was hit by a car Monday morning. We've been waiting with him until he died. But of course, you couldn't be expected to know that, could you? Bakers can't know everything, can they, Mr. Baker? But he's dead. He's dead, you bastard! Just as suddenly as it had welled in her, the anger dwindled, gave way to something else, a dizzy feeling of nausea. She leaned against the wooden table that was sprinkled with flour, put her hands over her face, and began to cry, her shoulders rocking back and forth.
It isn't fair, she said. It isn't fair.
Howard put his hand at the small of her back and looked at the baker.
Shame on you, Howard said to him. Shame.
The baker put the rolling pin back on the counter. He undid his apron and threw it on the counter. He looked at them, and then he shook his head slowly. He pulled a chair out from under the card table that held papers and receipts, an adding machine, and a telephone directory.
Please sit down, he said. Let me get you a chair, he said to Howard. Sit down now, please.
The baker went into the front of the shop and returned with two little wrought iron chairs.
Please sit down, you people.
Anne wiped her eyes and looked at the baker. I wanted to kill you, she said. I wanted you dead. The baker had cleared a space for them at the table. He shoved the adding machine to one side, along with the stacks of notepaper and receipts. He pushed the telephone directory onto the floor where it landed with a thud. Howard and Anne sat down and pulled their chairs up to the table. The baker sat down too.
Let me say how sorry I am, the baker said, putting his elbows on the table. God alone knows how sorry. Listen to me. I'm just a baker. I don't claim to be anything else. Maybe once, maybe years ago, I was a different kind of human being. I've forgotten, I don't know for sure. But I'm not any longer, if I ever was. Now I'm just a baker. That don't excuse my doing what I did, I know. But I'm deeply sorry. I'm sorry for your son, and I'm sorry for my part in this, the baker said.
He spread his hands out on the table and turned them over to reveal his palms.
I don't have any children myself, so I can only imagine what you must be feeling. All I can say to you now is that I'm sorry. Forgive me if you can, the baker said. I'm not an evil man, I don't think. Not evil, like you said on the phone. You got to understand what it comes down to is I don't know how to act anymore, it would seem. Please, the man said. Let me ask you if you can find it in your hearts to forgive me.
It was warm inside the bakery. Howard stood up from the table and took off his coat. He helped Anne from her coat. The baker looked at them for a minute and then nodded and got up from the table. He went to the oven and turned off some switches. He found cups and poured coffee from an electric coffee maker. He put a carton of cream on the table and a bowl of sugar.
You probably need to eat something, the baker said. I hope you'll eat some of my hot rolls. You have to eat and keep going. Eating is a small good thing in a time like this, he said.
He served them warm cinnamon rolls just out of the oven, the icing still runny.
He put butter on the table and knives to spread the butter. Then the baker sat down at the table with them. He waited. He waited until they each took a roll from the platter and began to eat.
"It's good to eat something," he said, watching them. "There's more. Eat up. Eat all you want. There's all the rolls in the world in here."
They ate rolls and drank coffee. Anne was suddenly hungry, and the rolls were warm and sweet. She ate three of them, which pleased the baker. Then he began to talk. They listened carefully. Although they were tired and in anguish, they listened to what the baker had to say. They nodded when the baker began to speak of loneliness, and of the sense of doubt and limitation that had come to him in his middle years. He told them what it was like to be childless all these years, to repeat the days with the ovens endlessly full and endlessly empty, the party food, the celebrations he'd worked over, icing knuckle deep, the tiny wedding couples stuck into cakes, hundreds of them, no, thousands by now, birthdays. Just imagine all those candles burning. He had a necessary trade. He was a baker. He was glad he wasn't a florist. It was better to be feeding people. This was a better smell any time than flowers.
"Smell this," the baker said, breaking open a dark loaf. "It's a heavy bread, but rich."
They smelled it. Then he had them taste it. It had the taste of molasses and coarse grains. They listened to him. They ate what they could. They swallowed the dark bread. It was like daylight under the fluorescent trays of light. They talked on into the early morning, the high, pale cast of light in the windows, and they did not think of leaving. Vitamins.
"I had a job and Patty didn't. I worked a few hours a night for the hospital. It was a nothing job. I did some work, signed the card for 8 hours, went drinking with the nurses. After a while, Patty wanted a job. She said she needed a job for her self-respect. So she started selling multiple vitamins door to door. For a while, she was just another girl who went up and down blocks in strange neighborhoods, knocking on doors. But she learned the ropes. She was quick and had excelled at things in school. She had personality. Pretty soon the company gave her a promotion. Some of the girls who weren't doing so hot were put to work under her. Before long, she had herself a crew and a little office out in the mall. But the girls who worked for her were always changing. Some would quit after a couple of days, after a couple of hours sometimes. But sometimes there were girls who were good at it. They could sell vitamins. These were the girls that stuck with Patty. They formed the core of the crew, but there were girls who couldn't give away vitamins. The girls who couldn't cut it would just quit, just not show up for work. If they had a phone, they'd take it off the hook. They wouldn't answer the door. Patty took these losses to heart, like the girls were new converts who had lost their way. She blamed herself, but she got over it. There were too many not to get over it. Once in a while, a girl would freeze and not be able to push the doorbell. Or maybe she'd get to the door and something would happen to her voice. Or she'd get the greeting mixed up with something she shouldn't be saying until she got inside. A girl like this, she'd decide to pack it in, take the sample case, head for the car, hang around until Patty and the others finished. There'd be a conference. Then they'd all ride back to the office. They'd say things to buck themselves up. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, and do the right things and the right things will happen. Things like that. Sometimes a girl just disappeared in the field, sample case and all. She'd hitch a ride into town, then beat it. But there were always girls to take her place. Girls were coming and going in those days. Patty had a list. Every few weeks she'd run a little ad in the Penny Saver. There'd be more girls and more training. There was no end of girls. The core group was made up of Patty, Donna, and Sheila. Patty was a looker. Donna and Sheila were only medium pretty. One night this Sheila said to Patty that she loved her more than anything on earth. Patty told me these were the words. Patty had driven Sheila home and they were sitting in front of Sheila's place. Patty said to Sheila she loved her too. Patty said to Sheila she loved all her girls.
but not in the way Sheila had in mind. Then Sheila touched Patty's breast. Patty said she took Sheila's hand and held it. She said she told her she didn't swing that way. She said Sheila didn't bat an eye, that she only nodded, held on to Patty's hand, kissed it, and got out of the car. That was around Christmas. The vitamin business was pretty bad off back then, so we thought we'd have a party to cheer everybody up. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Sheila was the first to get drunk and pass out. She passed out on her feet, fell over, and didn't wake up for hours. One minute she was standing in the middle of the living room, then her eyes closed, the legs buckled, and she went down with a glass in her hand. The hand holding the drink smacked the coffee table when she fell. She didn't make a sound otherwise. The drink poured out onto the rug. Patty and I and somebody else lugged her out to the back porch and put her down on a cot and did what we could to forget about her. Everybody got drunk and went home. Patty went to bed. I wanted to keep on, so I sat at the table with a drink until it began to get light out. Then Sheila came in from the porch and started up. She said she had this headache that was so bad it was like somebody was sticking wires in her brain. She said it was such a bad headache she was afraid it was going to leave her with a permanent squint. And she was sure her little finger was broken. She showed it to me. It looked purple. She bitched about us letting her sleep all night with her contacts in. She wanted to know, didn't anybody give a shit? She brought the finger up close and looked at it. She shook her head. She held the finger as far away as she could and looked some more. It was like she couldn't believe the things that must have happened to her that night. Her face was puffy and her hair was all over. She ran cold water on her finger.
God, oh God,
she said and cried some over the sink. But she'd made a serious pass at Patty, a declaration of love, and I didn't have any sympathy. I was drinking scotch and milk with a sliver of ice. Sheila was leaning on the drain board. She watched me from her little slits of eyes. I took some of my drink. I didn't say anything. She went back to telling me how bad she felt. She said she needed to see a doctor. She said she was going to wake Patty. She said she was quitting, leaving the state, going to Portland. That she had to say goodbye to Patty first. She kept on. She wanted Patty to drive her to the hospital for her finger and her eyes. I'll drive you, I said. I didn't want to do it, but I would.
I want Patty to drive me, Sheila said.
She was holding the wrist of her bad hand with her good hand, the little finger as big as a pocket flashlight.
Besides, we need to talk. I need to tell her I'm going to Portland. I need to say goodbye.
I said, I guess I'll have to tell her for you. She's asleep. Sheila turned mean.
We're friends, she said. I have to talk to her. I have to tell her myself.
I shook my head. She's asleep. I just said so.
We're friends and we love each other, Sheila said. I have to say goodbye to her.
Sheila made to leave the kitchen. I started to get up. I said, I'll drive you.
You're drunk. You haven't even been to bed yet.
She looked at her finger again and said,
God damn, why'd this have to happen?
Not too drunk to drive you to the hospital, I said.
I won't ride with you,
Sheila yelled. Suit yourself, but you're not going to wake Patty, lesbo bitch, I said.
Bastard,
she said. That's what she said, and then she went out of the kitchen and out the front door without using the bathroom or even washing her face. I got up and looked through the window. She was walking down the road toward Euclid. Nobody else was up. It was too early. I finished my drink and thought about fixing another one. I fixed it. Nobody saw any more of Sheila after that. None of us vitamin-related people, anyway. She walked to Euclid Avenue and out of our lives. Later on, Patty said,
What happened to Sheila?
And I said, She went to Portland. I had the hots for Donna, the other member of the core group. We'd danced to some Duke Ellington records that night of the party. I'd held her pretty tight, smelled her hair, kept a hand low on her back as I moved her over the rug. It was great dancing with her.
I was the only fellow at the party, and there were 7 girls, 6 of them dancing with each other. It was great just looking around the living room. I was in the kitchen when Donna came in with her empty glass. We were alone for a bit. I got her into a little embrace. She hugged me back. We stood there and hugged. Then she said,
"Don't. Not now."
When I heard that "not now," I let go. I figured it was money in the bank. I'd been at the table thinking about that hug when Sheila came in with her finger. I thought some more about Donna. I finished the drink. I took the phone off the hook and headed for the bedroom. I took off my clothes and got in next to Patty. I lay for a while, winding down. Then I started in. But she didn't wake up. Afterwards, I closed my eyes. It was the afternoon when I opened them again. I was in bed alone. Rain was blowing against the window. A sugar donut was lying on Patty's pillow, and a glass of cold water was on the nightstand. I was still drunk and couldn't figure anything out. I knew it was Sunday and close to Christmas. I ate the donut and drank the water. I went back to sleep until I heard Patty running the vacuum. She came into the bedroom and asked about Sheila. That's when I told her. Said she'd gone to Portland. A week or so into the new year, Patty and I were having a drink. She'd just come home from work. It wasn't so late, but it was dark and rainy. I was going to work in a couple of hours. But first, we were having some scotch and talking. Patty was tired. She was down in the dumps and into her third drink. Nobody was buying vitamins. All she had was Donna and Pam, a semi-new girl who was a klepto. We were talking about things like negative weather and the number of parking tickets you could get away with. Then we got to talking about how we'd be better off if we moved to Arizona, someplace like that. I fixed us another one. I looked out the window. Arizona wasn't a bad idea. Patty said,
"Vitamins."
She picked up her glass and spun the ice.
"For shit's sake," she said. "I mean, when I was a girl, this is the last thing I ever saw myself doing. Jesus, I never thought I'd grow up to sell vitamins. Door-to-door vitamins. This beats all. This really blows my mind."
"I never thought so either, honey," I said.
"That's right," she said. "You said it in a nutshell."
"Honey."
"Don't honey me," she said. "This is hard, brother. This life is not easy any way you cut it."
She seemed to think things over for a bit. She shook her head. Then she finished her drink. She said,
"I even dream of vitamins when I'm asleep. I don't have any relief. There's no relief. At least you can walk away from your job and leave it behind. I'll bet you haven't had one dream about it. I'll bet you don't dream about waxing floors or whatever you do down there. After you've left the goddamn place, you don't come home and dream about it, do you?"
She screamed. I said, "I can't remember what I dream. Maybe I don't dream. I don't remember anything when I wake up." I shrugged. I didn't keep track of what went on in my head when I was asleep. I didn't care.
"You dream," Patty said. "Even if you don't remember, everybody dreams. If you didn't dream, you'd go crazy. I read about it. It's an outlet. People dream when they're asleep, or else they'd go nuts. But when I dream of vitamins. Do you see what I'm saying?"
She had her eyes fixed on me. "Yes and no," I said. It wasn't a simple question.
"I dream I'm pitching vitamins," she said. "I'm selling vitamins day and night. Jesus, what a life," she said.
She finished her drink. "How's Pam doing?" I said. "She's still stealing things." I wanted to get us off this subject, but there wasn't anything else I could think of. Patty said,
"Shit,"
and shook her head like I didn't know anything. We listened to it rain.
"Nobody's selling vitamins," Patty said.
She picked up her glass, but it was empty.
"Nobody's buying vitamins. That's what I'm telling you. Didn't you hear me?"
I got up to fix us another. "Donna doing anything?" I said. I read the label on the bottle and waited. Patty said,
"She made a little sale 2 days ago. That's all. That's all that any of us has done this week. It wouldn't surprise me if she quit."
"I wouldn't blame her," Patty said.
If I was in her place, I'd quit. But if she quits, then what? Then I'm back at the start, that's what. Ground zero. Middle of winter, people sick all over the state, people dying, and nobody thinks they need vitamins. I'm sick as hell myself.
What's wrong, honey? I put the drinks on the table and sat down. She went on like I hadn't said anything. Maybe I hadn't.
I'm my only customer, she said. I think taking all these vitamins is doing something to my skin. Does my skin look okay to you? Can a person get overdosed on vitamins? I'm getting to where I can't even take a crap like a normal person.
Honey, I said. Patty said.
You don't care if I take vitamins. That's the point. You don't care about anything. The windshield wiper quit this afternoon in the rain. I almost had a wreck. I came this close.
We went on drinking and talking until it was time for me to go to work. Patty said she was going to soak in a tub if she didn't fall asleep first.
I'm asleep on my feet, she said.
She said,
vitamins. That's all there is anymore.
She looked around the kitchen. She looked at her empty glass. She was drunk. But she let me kiss her. Then I left for work. There was a place I went to after work. I'd started going for the music and because I could get a drink there after closing hours. It was a place called the Off-Broadway. It was a spade place in a spade neighborhood. It was run by a spade named Khaki. People would show up after the other places had stopped serving. They'd ask for house specials, RC Colas with a shooter of whiskey, or else they'd bring their own stuff under their coats, order RC, and build their own. Musicians showed up to jam, and the drinkers who wanted to keep drinking came to drink and listen to the music. Sometimes people danced, but mainly they sat around and drank and listened. Now and then a spade hit a spade in the head with a bottle. A story went around once that somebody had followed somebody into the gents and cut the man's throat while he had his hands down, pissing. But I never saw any trouble. Nothing that Khaki couldn't handle. Khaki was a big spade with a bald head that lit up weird under the fluorescence. He wore Hawaiian shirts that hung over his pants. I think he carried something inside his waistband. At least a sap, maybe. If somebody started to get out of line, Khaki would go over to where it was beginning. He'd rest his big hand on the party's shoulder and say a few words, and that was that. I'd been going there off and on for months. I was pleased that he'd say things to me, things like, "How are you doing tonight, friend?" Or, "Friend, I haven't seen you for a spell." The Off-Broadway is where I took Donna on our date. It was the one date we ever had. I'd walked out of the hospital just after midnight. It had cleared up and stars were out. I still had this buzz on from the scotch I'd had with Patty. But I was thinking to hit New Jimmy's for a quick one on the way home. Donna's car was parked in the space next to my car, and Donna was inside the car. I remembered that hug we'd had in the kitchen.
"Not now," she'd said.
She rolled the window down and knocked ashes from her cigarette.
"I couldn't sleep," she said. "I have some things on my mind and I couldn't sleep."
I said, "Donna. Hey, I'm glad to see you, Donna."
"I don't know what's wrong with me," she said.
"You want to go someplace for a drink?" I said.
"Patty's my friend," she said.
"She's my friend too," I said. Then I said, "Let's go."
"Just so you know," she said.
"There's this place. It's a spade place," I said. "They have music. We can get a drink, listen to some music."
"You want to drive me?"
Donna said. I said, "Scoot over." She started right in about vitamins. Vitamins were on the skids. Vitamins had taken a nosedive. The bottom had fallen out of the vitamin market. Donna said,
"I hate to do this to Patty. She's my best friend and she's trying to build things up for us. But I may have to quit. This is between us. Swear it. But I have to eat. I have to pay rent. I need new shoes and a new coat."
"Vitamins can't cut it," Donna said.
"I don't think vitamins is where it's at anymore. I haven't said anything to Patty. Like I said, I'm still just thinking about it."
Donna laid her hand next to my leg. I reached down and squeezed her fingers. She squeezed back. Then she took her hand away and pushed in the lighter. After she had her cigarette going, she put the hand back.
Worse than anything, I hate to let Patty down. You know what I'm saying? We were a team.
She reached me her cigarette.
I know it's a different brand, she said. But try it, go ahead.
I pulled into the lot for the off-Broadway. Three spades were up against an old Chrysler that had a cracked windshield. They were just lounging, passing a bottle in a sack. They looked us over. I got out and went around to open up for Donna. I checked the doors, took her arm, and we headed for the street. The spades just watched us. I said, "You're not thinking about moving to Portland, are you?" We were on the sidewalk. I put my arm around her waist.
"I don't know anything about Portland. Portland hasn't crossed my mind once."
The front half of the off-Broadway was like a regular cafe and bar. A few spades sat at the counter, and a few more worked over plates of food at tables with red oilcloth. We went through the cafe and into the big room in back. There was a long counter with booths against the wall, and farther back a platform where musicians could set up. In front of the platform was what passed for a dance floor. The bars and nightclubs were still serving, so people hadn't turned up in any real numbers yet. I helped Donna take off her coat. We picked a booth and put our cigarettes on the table. The spade waitress named Hannah came over. Hannah and me nodded. She looked at Donna. I ordered us two RC specials and decided to feel good about things. After the drinks came and I'd paid and we'd each had a sip, we started hugging. We carried on like this for a while, squeezing and patting, kissing each other's face. Every so often, Donna would stop and draw back, push me away a little, then hold me by the wrists. She'd gaze into my eyes. Then her lids would close slowly and we'd fall to kissing again. Pretty soon the place began to fill up. We stopped kissing. But I kept my arm around her. She put her fingers on my leg. A couple of spade horn players and a white drummer began fooling around with something. I figured Donna and me would have another drink and listen to the set. Then we'd leave and go to her place to finish things. I just ordered two more from Hannah when this spade named Benny came over with this other spade, this big dressed-up spade. This big spade had little red eyes and was wearing a three-piece pinstripe. He had on a rose-colored shirt, a tie, a top coat, a fedora, all of it. "How's my man?" said Benny. Benny stuck out his hand for a brother handshake. Benny and I had talked. He knew I liked the music, and he used to come over to talk whenever we were both in the place. He liked to talk about Johnny Hodges, how he'd played sax backup for Johnny.
Note: Hodges, 1906 to 1970, longtime alto saxophonist for the Duke Ellington Orchestra, led his own big band from 1950 to 1955. End of note.
He'd say things like, "When Johnny and me had this gig in Mason City." "Hi, Benny," I said.
"I want you to meet Nelson," Benny said. "He just back from Nam today, this morning. He here to listen to some of these good sounds. He got on his dancing shoes in case."
Benny looked at Nelson and nodded.
"This here is Nelson."
I was looking at Nelson's shiny shoes. And then I looked at Nelson. He seemed to want to place me from somewhere. He studied me. Then he let loose a rolling grin that showed his teeth. "This is Donna," I said. "Donna, this is Benny, and this is Nelson. Nelson, this is Donna." "Hello, girl," Nelson said. And Donna said right back,
"Hello there, Nelson. Hello, Benny. Maybe we'll just slide in and join you folks," Benny said. "Okay?"
I said, "Sure." But I was sorry they hadn't found someplace else. "We're not going to be here long," I said. "Just long enough to finish this drink is all."
"I know, man, I know," Benny said. He sat across from me after Nelson had let himself down into the booth. "Things to do, places to go. Yes, sir, Benny knows," Benny said and winked. Nelson looked across the booth to Donna. Then he took off the hat. He seemed to be looking for something on the brim as he turned the hat around in his big hands. He made room for the hat on the table. He looked up at Donna. He grinned and squared his shoulders. He had to square his shoulders every few minutes. It was like he was very tired of carrying them around.
You real good friends with him, I bet, Nelson said to Donna.
We're good friends, Donna said.
Hannah came over. Benny asked for RCs. Hannah went away, and Nelson worked a pint of whiskey from his topcoat.
Good friends, Nelson said. Real good friends.
He unscrewed the cap on his whiskey.
Watch it, Nelson, Benny said. Keep that out of sight. Nelson just got off the plane from Nam, Benny said.
Nelson raised the bottle and drank some of his whiskey. He screwed the cap back on, laid the bottle on the table, and put his hat down on top of it.
Real good friends, he said.
Benny looked at me and rolled his eyes, but he was drunk too.
I got to get into shape, he said to me.
He drank RC from both of their glasses and then held the glasses under the table and poured whiskey. He put the bottle in his coat pocket.
Man, I ain't put my lips to a reed for a month now. I got to get with it.
We were bunched in the booth, glasses in front of us, Nelson's hat on the table.
You, Nelson said to me. You with somebody else, ain't you? This beautiful woman, she ain't your wife. I know that. But you real good friends with this woman. Ain't I right?
I had some of my drink. I couldn't taste the whiskey. I couldn't taste anything. I said, is all that shit about Vietnam true we see on the TV?
Nelson had his red eyes fixed on me. He said, what I want to say is, do you know where your wife is? I bet she out with some dude and she be seizing his nipples for him and pulling his pud for him while you sitting here big as life with your good friend. I bet she have herself a good friend too.
Nelson, Benny said.
Nelson nothing, Nelson said.
Benny said,
Nelson, let's leave these people be. There's somebody in that other booth, somebody I told you about. Nelson just this morning got off a plane.
Benny said,
I bet I know what you're thinking, Nelson said. I bet you're thinking, now here a big drunk nigger, and what am I going to do with him? Maybe I have to whip his ass for him. That what you're thinking?
I looked around the room. I saw Khaki standing near the platform, the musicians working away behind him. Some dancers were on the floor. I thought Khaki looked right at me, but if he did, he looked away again.
Ain't it your turn to talk? Nelson said. I just teasing you. I ain't done any teasing since I left Nam. I teased the gooks some.
He grinned again, his big lips rolling back. Then he stopped grinning and just stared.
Show them that ear, Benny said.
He put his glass on the table.
Nelson got himself an ear off one of them little dudes, Benny said. He carry it with him. Show them, Nelson.
Nelson sat there. Then he started feeling the pockets of his topcoat. He took things out of one pocket. He took out some keys and a box of cough drops.
Donna said, I don't want to see an ear. Ugh. Double ugh. Jesus.
She looked at me. We have to go, I said. Nelson was still feeling in his pockets. He took a wallet from a pocket inside the suit coat and put it on the table. He patted the wallet.
Five big ones there. Listen here, he said to Donna. I'm going to give you two bills. You with me? I give you two big ones, and then you French me. Just like his woman doing some other big fellow, you hear? You know she got her mouth on somebody's hammer right this minute while he here with his hand up your skirt. Fair's fair. Here.
He pulled the corners of the bills from his wallet.
Hell, here another 100 for your good friend so he won't feel left out. You don't have to do nothing. You don't have to do nothing, Nelson said to me. You just sit there and drink your drink and listen to the music. Good music. Me and this woman walk out together like good friends. And she walked back in by herself. Won't be long she'd be back. Nelson, Benny said. This is no way to talk, Nelson. Nelson grinned. I've finished talking, he said. He found what he'd been feeling for. It was a silver cigarette case. He opened it up. I looked at the ear inside. It sat on a bed of cotton. It looked like a dried mushroom, but it was a real ear and it was hooked up to a keychain. Jesus, said Donna. Yuck. Ain't that something? Nelson said. He was watching Donna. No way. Fuck off, Donna said. Girl, Nelson said. Nelson, I said. And then Nelson fixed his red eyes on me. He pushed the hat and wallet and cigarette case out of his way. What do you want? Nelson said. I give you what you want. Khaki had a hand on my shoulder and the other one on Benny's shoulder. He leaned over the table, his head shining under the light. How you folks? You all having fun? Everything all right, Khaki, Benny said. Everything A-okay. These people here was just fixing to leave. Me and Nelson going to sit and listen to the music. That's good, Khaki said. Folks be happy is my motto. He looked around the booth. He looked at Nelson's wallet on the table and at the open cigarette case next to the wallet. He saw the ear. That a real ear? Khaki said. Benny said, it is. Show him that ear, Nelson. Nelson just stepped off the plane from Nam with his ear. This ear has traveled halfway around the world to be on this table tonight. Nelson, show him, Benny said. Nelson picked up the case and handed it to Khaki. Khaki examined the ear. He took up the chain and dangled the ear in front of his face. He looked at it. He let it swing back and forth on the chain. I heard about these dried up ears and dicks and such. I took it off one of them gooks, Nelson said. He couldn't hear nothing with it no more. I wanted me a keepsake. Khaki turned the ear on its chain. Donna and I began getting out of the booth. Girl, don't go, Nelson said. Nelson, Benny said. Khaki was watching Nelson now. I stood beside the booth with Donna's coat. My legs were crazy. Nelson raised his voice. He said, you go with his mother here, you let him put his face in your sweets, you both going to have to deal with me. We started to move away from the booth. People were looking. Nelson just got off the plane from Nam this morning, I heard Benny say. We've been drinking all day. It's been the longest day on record, but me and him, we going to be fine, Khaki. Nelson yelled something over the music. He yelled, it ain't going to do no good. Whatever you do, it ain't going to help none. I heard him say that, and then I couldn't hear any more. The music stopped, and then it started again. We didn't look back. We kept going. We got out to the sidewalk. I opened the door for her. I started us back to the hospital. Donna stayed over on her side. She'd used the lighter on a cigarette, but she wouldn't talk. I tried to say something. I said, look, Donna, don't get on a downer because of this. I'm sorry it happened, I said. I could have used the money, Donna said. That's what I was thinking. I kept driving and didn't look at her. It's true, she said. I could have used the money. She shook her head. I don't know, she said. She put her chin down and cried. Don't cry, I said. I'm not going into work tomorrow, today, whenever it is the alarm goes off, she said. I'm not going in. I'm leaving town.
I'll take what happened back there as a sign.
She pushed in the lighter and waited for it to pop out. I pulled in beside my car and killed the engine. I looked in the rear view, half thinking I'd see that old Chrysler drive into the lot behind me with Nelson in the seat. I kept my hands on the wheel for a minute, and then dropped them to my lap. I didn't want to touch Donna. The hug we'd given each other in my kitchen that night, the kissing we'd done at the off-Broadway, that was all over. I said, "What are you going to do?" But I didn't care. Right then, she could have died of a heart attack and it wouldn't have meant anything.
"Maybe I could go up to Portland," she said. "There must be something in Portland. Portland's on everybody's mind these days. Portland's a drawing card. Portland this, Portland that. Portland's as good a place as any. It's all the same."
"Donna," I said, "I'd better go." I started to let myself out. I cracked the door and the overhead light came on.
"For Christ's sake, turn off that light."
I got out in a hurry. "Night, Donna," I said. I left her staring at the dashboard. I started up my car and turned on the lights. I slipped it in gear and fed it the gas. I poured scotch, drank some of it, and took the glass into the bathroom. I brushed my teeth. Then I pulled open a drawer. Patty yelled something from the bedroom. She opened the bathroom door. She was still dressed. She'd been sleeping with her clothes on, I guess.
"What time is it?" she screamed. "I've overslept. Jesus, oh my God, you've let me oversleep, goddamn you."
She was wild. She stood in the doorway with her clothes on. She could have been fixing to go to work, but there was no sample case, no vitamins. She was having a bad dream is all. She began shaking her head from side to side. I couldn't take any more tonight. "Go back to sleep, honey. I'm looking for something," I said. I knocked some stuff out of the medicine chest. Things rolled into the sink. "Where's the aspirin?" I said. I knocked down some more things. I didn't care. Things kept falling.
Careful.
After a lot of talking, what his wife Inez called assessment, Lloyd moved out of the house and into his own place. He had two rooms and a bath on the top floor of a three-story house. Inside the rooms, the roof slanted down sharply. If he walked around, he had to duck his head. He had to stoop to look from his windows and be careful getting in and out of bed. There were two keys. One key led him into the house itself. Then he climbed some stairs that passed through the house to a landing. He went up another flight of stairs to the door of his room and used the other key on that lock. Once, when he was coming back to his place in the afternoon, carrying a sack with three bottles of André champagne and some lunch meat, he stopped on the landing and looked into his landlady's living room. He saw the old woman lying on her back on the carpet. She seemed to be asleep. Then it occurred to him she might be dead. But the TV was going, so he chose to think she was asleep. He didn't know what to make of it. He moved the sack from one arm to the other. It was then that the woman gave a little cough, brought her hand to her side, and went back to being quiet and still again. Lloyd continued on up the stairs and unlocked his door. Later that day, toward evening, as he looked from his kitchen window, he saw the old woman, down in the yard, wearing a straw hat and holding her hand against her side. She was using a little watering can on some pansies. In his kitchen, he had a combination refrigerator and stove. The refrigerator and stove was a tiny affair wedged into a space between the sink and the wall. He had to bend over, almost get down on his knees to get anything out of the refrigerator. But it was all right because he didn't keep much in there anyway, except fruit juice, lunch meat, and champagne. The stove had two burners. Now and then he heated water in a saucepan and made instant coffee. But some days he didn't drink any coffee. He forgot, or else he just didn't feel like coffee. One morning he woke up and promptly fell to eating crumb donuts and drinking champagne. There'd been a time, some years back, when he would have laughed at having a breakfast like this.
Now there didn't seem to be anything very unusual about it. In fact, he hadn't thought anything about it until he was in bed and trying to recall the things he'd done that day, starting with when he'd gotten up that morning. At first, he couldn't remember anything noteworthy. Then he remembered eating those donuts and drinking champagne. Time was when he would have considered this a mildly crazy thing to do, something to tell friends about. Then, the more he thought about it, the more he could see it didn't matter much one way or the other. He'd had donuts and champagne for breakfast, so what? In his furnished rooms, he also had a dinette set, a little sofa, an old easy chair, and a TV set that stood on a coffee table. He wasn't paying the electricity here, and it wasn't even his TV, so sometimes he left the set on all day and all night. But he kept the volume down unless he saw there was something he wanted to watch. He did not have a telephone, which was fine with him. He didn't want a telephone. There was a bedroom with a double bed, a nightstand, a chest of drawers, a bathroom. The one time Inez came to visit, it was 11 o'clock in the morning. He'd been in his new place for 2 weeks, and he'd been wondering if she were going to drop by. But he was trying to do something about his drinking, too, so he was glad to be alone. He'd made that much clear. Being alone was the thing he needed most. The day she came, he was on the sofa in his pajamas, hitting his fist against the right side of his head. Just before he could hit himself again, he heard voices downstairs on the landing. He could make out his wife's voice. The sound was like the murmur of voices from a faraway crowd. But he knew it was Inez, and somehow knew the visit was an important one. He gave his head another jolt with his fist, then got to his feet. He'd awakened that morning and found that his ear had stopped up with wax. He couldn't hear anything clearly, and he seemed to have lost his sense of balance, his equilibrium in the process. For the last hour, he'd been on the sofa, working frustratedly on his ear, now and then slamming his head with his fist. Once in a while, he'd massage the gristly underpart of his ear, or else tug at his lobe. Then he'd dig furiously in his ear with his little finger and open his mouth, simulating yawns. But he'd tried everything he could think of, and he was nearing the end of his rope. He could hear voices below break off their murmuring. He pounded his head a good one and finished the glass of champagne. He turned off the TV and carried the glass to the sink. He picked up the open bottle of champagne from the drain board and took it into the bathroom, where he put it behind the stool. Then he went to answer the door. "Hi, Lloyd," Inez said. She didn't smile. She stood in the doorway in a bright spring outfit. He hadn't seen these clothes before. She was holding a canvas handbag that had sunflowers stitched onto its sides. He hadn't seen the handbag before either.
"I didn't think you heard me," she said. "I thought you might be gone or something. But the woman downstairs, what's her name? Mrs. Matthews? She thought you were up here."
"I heard you," Lloyd said, "but just barely."
He hitched his pajamas and ran a hand through his hair.
"Actually, I'm in one hell of a shape. Come on in."
"It's 11 o'clock, she said. She came inside and shut the door behind her. She acted as if she hadn't heard him. Maybe she hadn't.
"I know what time it is, he said. "I've been up for a long time. I've been up since 8. I watched part of the Today Show. But just now I'm about to go crazy with something. My ears plugged up. You remember that other time it happened? We were living in that place near the Chinese takeout joint, where the kids found that bulldog dragging its chain. I had to go to the doctor then and have my ears flushed out. I know you remember. You drove me and we had to wait a long time. Well, it's like that now. I mean, it's that bad. Only I can't go to a doctor this morning. I don't have a doctor for one thing. I'm about to go nuts, Inez. I feel like I want to cut my head off or something."
He sat down at one end of the sofa, and she sat down at the other end. But it was a small sofa, and they were still sitting close to each other. They were so close, he could have put out his hand and touched her knee. But he didn't. She glanced around the room and then fixed her eyes on him again. He knew he hadn't shaved and that his hair stood up. But she was his wife, and she knew everything there was to know about him.
"What have you tried?" she said.
She looked in her purse and brought up a cigarette. "I mean, what have you done for it so far?"
What'd you say?
He turned the left side of his head to her.
Inez, I swear I'm not exaggerating. This thing is driving me crazy. When I talk, I feel like I'm talking inside a barrel. My head rumbles, and I can't hear good either. When you talk, it sounds like you're talking through a lead pipe.
Do you have any Q-tips? Or else Wesson oil?
Inez said. Honey, this is serious, he said. I don't have any Q-tips or Wesson oil. Are you kidding?
If we had some Wesson oil, I could heat it and put some of that in your ear. My mother used to do that, she said. It might soften things up in there.
He shook his head.
His head felt full and like it was awash with fluid. It felt like it had when he used to swim near the bottom of the municipal pool and come up with his ears filled with water. But back then, it had been easy to clear the water out. All he had to do was fill his lungs with air, close his mouth, and clamp down on his nose. Then he'd blow out his cheeks and force air into his head. His ears would pop, and for a few seconds he'd have the pleasant sensation of water running out of his head and dripping onto his shoulders. Then he'd heave himself out of the pool. Inez finished her cigarette and put it out.
Lloyd, we have things to talk about, but I guess we'll have to take things one at a time. Go sit in the chair. Not that chair, the chair in the kitchen, so we can have some light on the situation.
He whacked his head once more. Then he went over to sit on a dinette chair. She moved over and stood behind him. She touched his hair with her fingers. Then she moved the hair away from his ears. He reached for her hand, but she drew it away.
Which ear did you say it was?
She said.
The right ear, he said. The right one.
First, she said, you have to sit here and not move. I'll find a hairpin and some tissue paper. I'll try to get in there with that. Maybe it'll do the trick.
He was alarmed at the prospect of her putting a hairpin inside his ear. He said something to that effect.
What? She said. Christ, I can't hear you either. Maybe this is catching.
When I was a kid in school, Lloyd said, we had this health teacher. She was like a nurse, too. She said we should never put anything smaller than an elbow into our ear.
He vaguely remembered a wall chart showing a massive diagram of the ear, along with an intricate system of canals, passageways, and walls.
Well, your nurse was never faced with this exact problem, Inez said. Anyway, we need to try something. We'll try this first. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. That's life, isn't it?
Does that have a hidden meaning or something? Lloyd said.
It means just what I said. But you're free to think as you please. I mean, it's a free country, she said. Now let me get fixed up with what I need. You just sit there.
She went through her purse, but she didn't find what she was looking for. Finally, she emptied her purse out onto the sofa.
No hairpins, she said. Damn.
But it was as if she were saying the words from another room. In a way, it was almost as if he'd imagined her saying them. There'd been a time, long ago, when they used to feel they had ESP when it came to what the other one was thinking. They could finish sentences that the other had started. She picked up some nail clippers, worked for a minute, and then he saw the device separate in her fingers and part of it swing away from the other part. A nail file protruded from the clippers. It looked to him as if she were holding a small dagger.
You're going to put that in my ear? He said.
Maybe you have a better idea, she said. It's this or else I don't know what. Maybe you have a pencil? You want me to use that? Or maybe you have a screwdriver around, she said and laughed. Don't worry. Listen, Lloyd, I won't hurt you. I said I'd be careful. I'll wrap some tissue around the end of this. It'll be all right. I'll be careful, like I said. You just stay where you are and I'll get some tissue for this. I'll make a swab.
She went into the bathroom. She was gone for a time. He stayed where he was on the dinette chair. He began thinking of things he ought to say to her. He wanted to tell her he was limiting himself to champagne and champagne only. He wanted to tell her he was tapering off the champagne, too. It was only a matter of time now. But when she came back into the room, he couldn't say anything. He didn't know where to start. But she didn't look at him anyway. She fished a cigarette from the heap of things she'd emptied onto the sofa cushion. She lit the cigarette with her lighter and went to stand by the window that faced onto the street.
She said something, but he couldn't make out the words. When she stopped talking, he didn't ask her what it was she'd said. Whatever it was, he knew he didn't want to hear her say it again. She put out the cigarette, but she went on standing at the window, leaning forward, the slope of the roof just inches from her head.
Inez, he said.
She turned and came over to him. He could see tissue on the point of the nail file. Turn your head to the side and keep it that way, she said. That's right. Sit still now and don't move. Don't move, she said again.
Be careful, he said. For Christ's sake.
She didn't answer him.
Please, please, he said.
Then he didn't say any more. He was afraid. He closed his eyes and held his breath as he felt the nail file turn past the inner part of his ear and begin its probe. He was sure his heart would stop beating. Then she went a little farther and began turning the blade back and forth, working at whatever it was in there. Inside his ear, he heard a squeaking sound. Ouch, he said. Did I hurt you? She took the nail file out of his ear and moved back a step. Does anything feel different, Lloyd? He brought his hands up to his ears and lowered his head.
It's just the same, he said.
She looked at him and bit her lips.
Let me go to the bathroom, he said. Before we go any farther, I have to go to the bathroom.
Go ahead, Inez said. I think I'll go downstairs and see if your landlady has any Wesson oil or anything like that. She might even have some Q-tips. I don't know why I didn't think of that before, of asking her.
That's a good idea, he said. I'll go to the bathroom.
She stopped at the door and looked at him, and then she opened the door and went out. He crossed the living room, went into his bedroom, and opened the bathroom door. He reached down behind the stool and brought up the bottle of champagne. He took a long drink. It was warm, but it went right down. He took some more. In the beginning, he'd really thought he could continue drinking if he limited himself to champagne. But in no time, he found he was drinking 3 or 4 bottles a day. He knew he'd have to deal with this pretty soon. But first, he'd have to get his hearing back. One thing at a time, just like she'd said. He finished off the rest of the champagne and put the empty bottle in its place behind the stool. Then he ran water and brushed his teeth. After he'd used the towel, he went back into the other room. Inez had returned and was at the stove heating something in a little pan. She glanced in his direction, but didn't say anything at first. He looked past her shoulder and out the window. A bird flew from one tree to another and preened its feathers. But if it made any kind of bird noise, he didn't hear it. She said something that he didn't catch.
Say again, he said.
She shook her head and turned back to the stove. But then she turned again and said, loud enough and slow enough so he could hear it. I found your stash in the bathroom.
I'm trying to cut back, he said.
She said something else.
What?
He said.
What'd you say?
He really hadn't heard her. We'll talk later, she said. We have things to discuss, Lloyd. Money is one thing, but there are other things too. First, we have to see about this ear. She put her finger into the pan and then took the pan off the stove. I'll let it cool for a minute, she said. It's too hot right now. Sit down. Put this towel around your shoulders. He did as he was told. He sat on a chair and put the towel around his neck and shoulders. Then he hit the side of his head with his fist.
God damn it, he said.
She didn't look up. She put her finger into the pan once more, testing. Then she poured the liquid from the pan into his plastic glass. She picked up the glass and came over to him. Don't be scared, she said. It's just some of your landlady's baby oil, that's all it is. I told her what was wrong and she thought this might help. No guarantees, Inez said. But maybe this will loosen things up in there. She said it used to happen to her husband. She said this one time she saw a piece of wax fall out of his ear, and it was like a big plug of something. It was earwax, that's what it was. She said, try this. And she didn't have any Q-tips. I can't understand that, her not having any Q-tips. That part really surprises me.
Okay, he said. All right, I'm willing to try anything. Inez, if I had to go on like this, I think I'd rather be dead. You know? I mean it, Inez.
Tilt your head all the way to the side now, she said. Don't move.
I'll pour this in until your ear fills up, then I'll stopper it with this dish rag. And you just sit there for 10 minutes, say. Then we'll see. If this doesn't do it, well, I don't have any other suggestions. I just don't know what to do then.
This'll work, he said. If this doesn't work, I'll find a gun and shoot myself. I'm serious. That's what I feel like doing anyway.
He turned his head to the side and let it hang down. He looked at the things in the room from this new perspective, but it wasn't any different from the old way of looking, except that everything was on its side. Farther, she said. He held on to the chair for balance and lowered his head even more. All of the objects in his vision, all of the objects in his life, it seemed, were at the far end of this room. He could feel the warm liquid pour into his ear. Then she brought the dish rag up and held it there. In a little while, she began to massage the area around his ear. She pressed into the soft part of the flesh between his jaw and skull. She moved her fingers to the area over his ear and began to work the tips of her fingers back and forth. After a while, he didn't know how long he'd been sitting there. It could have been 10 minutes. It could have been longer. He was still holding onto the chair. Now and then, as her fingers pressed the side of his head, he could feel the warm oil she'd poured in there wash back and forth in the canals inside his ear. When she pressed a certain way, he imagined he could hear, inside his head, a soft, swishing sound. Sit up straight, Inez said. He sat up and pressed the heel of his hand against his head while the liquid poured out of his ear. She caught it in the towel. Then she wiped the outside of his ear. Inez was breathing through her nose. Lloyd heard the sound her breath made as it came and went. He heard a car pass on the street outside the house and, at the back of the house, down below his kitchen window, the clear snick-snick of pruning shears. Well? Inez said. She waited with her hands on her hips, frowning. I can hear you, he said. I'm all right. I mean, I can hear.